You're listening to Make It Thrive, the company culture podcast. I'm your host, Lizzie Benton, company culture coach and founder of Liberty Mind, and I want to inspire people to create progressive company cultures where our human potential can thrive. In this podcast, I talk to organizations, thought leaders, and change makers about the impact of company culture. Together, we can make it thrive. This year, Make It Thrive is supporting Teal Around the World, one of the biggest conferences dedicated to the Teal philosophy. With around 5,000 participants since it first started, Teal Around the World brings together keynote speakers, practical workshops, and storytelling sessions, gathering experienced pioneers and thought leaders like Frederick Laloux, Jos and Thijs de Blok, Gary Hamel, Doug Kirkpatrick, Daniela Lander, and Ricardo Semler, sharing their stories based on practical experiences ranging from startups to huge corporations. Thanks to Teal Around the World, attendees have been empowered to start a change within themselves and their spheres of influence. Now, entering a new era, Teal Around the World would like to bring inspiration to real life. The best part being real connection, building relationships, and creating a network of possibilities. In 2025, Teal Around the World will adopt a hybrid format. Global hubs in different locations all around the world will host local keynotes and storytellers live on stage. This conference will give a chance for participants to experience hands-on workshops in small groups, short speaker reflection sessions, holistic and out-of-the-box experiences, whilst having people from other parts of the globe join virtually. If you'd like to know more, please check out their website in the show notes or consider donating to their crowdfunding page. We hope you'll join us on a venture to change the world. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Make It Thrive. Today's episode is really the Kickstarter for season 12 as we dive into making the intangible more tangible. And what better way to start this season than to have a deep and meaningful conversation with Catherine Bernard. I met Kat through my work with Semco Style Institute here in the UK, as Kat very kindly was a guest speaker at one of our webinars, and immediately I was struck by Kat's wisdom and her profound insight into how we look at shaping the future of work. So to give you a bit of background on Kat, she co-founded Working the Future in 2016 to help business leaders prepare for and adapt to the future of work. Today, she and her team provide organizations with work trend intelligence and advisory services to help create easy to implement, people-centered, future-proofing strategies. In this episode, Kat and I sit down and talk about the theme of becoming. Because when the world around us is influencing us to act or project ourselves in a certain type of way, how do we keep connected to our authenticity and what we can create in the world? And it really ties nicely so much to how can we put theory into action. So I felt like this episode was a brilliant one to really start the season and to help us land in making some of these more intangible topics and areas more tangible, and how we can really come to a place of acceptance of the journey rather than always trying to push for the destination. So let's dive in.
Hi, Kat, and welcome to Make It Thrive, the company culture podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you on, and we've already spilled into a bit of a conversation pre-podcast about books, which my book list has got so much bigger ever since talking with you, Kat, and I know today's conversation is probably going to do the same for everybody else listening. So on today's conversation, we wanted to talk about becoming. And that's kind of the theme of our conversation today. Did you want to kind of describe what this means to you? Any stories or examples?
I think that, I guess the comment that I would start our conversation with is, you know, as we sit in 2024, I think it's fair to say there are no shortage of books or videos or podcasts or other informational stimuli that could tell you how you ought to be. And I think probably I just want to offer up the antidote to that, which is, you know, beyond defining what your personal value code is and how you want to authentically show up in the world, there is no roadmap for how you are going to live your life. And I think we get ourselves caught up in trying to be something that we're not in pursuit of ideals that don't fit our souls. And I think it breeds a culture of perfectionism and actually a culture of anxiety, because we're constantly striving to live into a version of ourselves that isn't authentic, whereas the real version of ourselves is one that is in perpetual formation, hence becoming.
Oh my goodness, that was a pretty powerful start there, Kat. I've got goosebumps. I'm like, oh my goodness, I wish I'd been told this when I was like 10 years younger.
Well, it did take me some time to get here, so I can say this with the wisdom of 52 years, but it just strikes me. The more we progress into uncharted, uncertain landscapes, it strikes me that none of us are doing any favours if we ascribe to an ideology that suggests that we should be anything other than who we truly are in our hearts and in our souls. And I think if we can identify with who we're authentically meant to be, then we will come to be of service best to ourselves and to society and whoever it is that we wish to serve. And I, at my heart, I believe most humans want to be helpful.
Do you know, I feel like it's really a relevant conversation to be having at the moment as well, because I really saw over the January period, I'm sure you probably did too, Kat, there was this kind of backlash against the new year, new me kind of conversation that always happens, and where we're having to shape shift ourselves again and, you know, buy into whatever kind of trend or fad that's coming up and feel like we have to change who we are all over again because of the start of the new year. And it's just absolutely exhausting.
Yep. And relentless. And I don't think I'm overstating it if I say that most of us are living in a state of quasi-exhaustion all the time. It is exhausting not to know what lies ahead of us. It's exhausting when a government gaslights its constituents and pretends that things are normal when they're clearly not. It's exhausting trying to exist within an economy that is anything but stable. And the idea that we could overlay any of that uncertainty with 10 ways to live your best life in 2024 is insane. And actually, two things. One, those messages, I would wager that most of those messages have some intent to sell you a better version of yourself lying underneath them. And two, you know, we're at the very outer limits now of systems resilience. So these systems that tell us that if we only press buy on this website, or if we only, you know, buy that dress, buy that holiday, buy that book, buy that whatever, things will be better. We don't have to do any of that. We don't have to subscribe to any of that. That's a broken system trying to uphold itself. And if we feel at odds with that, the only thing that I would say is, if you're listening to this and you have been feeling at odds with this cultural narrative that if only we did X, Y, and Z, then life would improve and these things would happen. If you're feeling at odds with that, that is, just please know that is not anything to do with you. That is everything to do with the death throes of a dying system. And yeah, what you feel in your heart is probably more potent than any of these cultural narratives that are being thrust upon us still.
Yeah, it's so interesting actually, because just recently I have come off Instagram for a while because I felt like, and you know, social media, as we know, is always there really to sell us something. It is an advertising platform, essentially. We can pretend that it's there to connect us and all of those kind of things. But I came away from it because I was just starting to see so much of us selling ourselves. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's bad enough that it happens on LinkedIn, but now we've got on Instagram this kind of weird kind of cultural phenomenon where people are like selling who they are and like, you know, this is what I'm, and I just found it really bizarre that basically everybody on that platform is selling a version of something, and we kind of buy into it as it's some kind of reality, and then we get caught up thinking that we need to be doing these things or we must have these things, or it's really bizarre. And ever since I've stepped back, I mean, I've been off it for about 2 weeks now, and it's so interesting how I don't actually feel a need to go back on.
So I think any of these social media platforms, whenever we engage with them in a way that means that we're publishing something about ourselves rather than consuming information about others, which is the entire draw, right? But you know, whenever we do that, we're putting our best foot forward and we're publishing a very polished, edited version of ourselves. And therein lies the perpetuation of the culture of perfectionism. And you know, a counter argument to that could be easily, if you feel the compulsion to post a version of your life on a daily basis on a social media platform, the chances are you're not living your best life. My daughter, who's in her late teens, in line with her classmates, they all latched on to Be Real a couple of years ago. And I find it really interesting that, as far as I understand it, and I'm sure there'll be a listener who says, no, you've misunderstood all of that. I understand the purpose of Be Real to be a 60 to 120 second snapshot of you being your most authentic self, right? As an antidote to the mainstream social media platforms. And yet, it is always entertaining to watch. And she doesn't do them publicly, she tries to do them privately, but occasionally I see her doing them, you know, just to watch the kind of the postures and the posing and what have you. And I just think, that's the world that we live in now, isn't it? And what about any of that? What about any of that can possibly make us feel good about ourselves?
Yeah, it's so strange, isn't it? And it's this kind of, you wonder how, you know, that kind of, you're, because I look back and I was so grateful when I was younger that I had MySpace. So I hit college and MySpace was the big thing. And you had like, Tom was your first friend. And even then, I was so grateful that I didn't have social media, you know, when I was younger, because I kind of look at well, how do we develop that kind of resilience to life and that fact that we're going to be character building throughout our lives? You know, who we are now is going to be a different person maybe in the next 10 years. And it's that sense of almost like that sense of certainty that this is who I am and this is how I've got to perceive myself. When actually we're going to grow, we're going to develop, and that version, you know, I can't imagine how it's going to be and what the shift we're going to see generationally in the character building that they go through.
Yeah, there's something really interesting in there about whether or not when you live in a world where social media is so dominant, whether or not you are able to authentically post updates about yourself as you evolve, or whether there is any cognition about the fact that you must maintain a certain look and appeal to the people that follow you, otherwise they'll stop following you, and then whether that lends itself to an inauthenticity. When you started talking about MySpace, you just reminded me. So I'm obviously a little bit older than you, Lizzie, but I remember exactly where I was when somebody sent me a message saying, oh my God, you have to see this new platform. So I was working in Stockholm in Sweden in 2001, and somebody sent me an email saying, check this out, Friends Reunited. So for those who don't know, Friends Reunited was a British precursor to Facebook. And all of a sudden, you were able to link up with people that you had been to school with. And just again, if there are any international listeners, just to position this. So when I was at school, you could leave school at the age of 16. I was last year of O-levels. You could leave school and then either go into work or go to college. And then you would either do A-levels or some kind of post-O-level technical qualification. But, you know, somewhat after the fact. So I would have been rising 30 in 2001. And I got this email, and almost overnight, people of my age were flocking to this platform and putting on, you know, little status profiles and so on. And it was highly addictive, and it was a massive adrenaline rush because you were starting to peek into what other people that you'd long lost contact with were up to. And of course, you know, the draw was, oh, I wonder what happened to him. I wonder what happened to her. Oh my God, now I can see. Anyway, fast forward several months, maybe even a year, and somebody from my school organised a meetup. And there was lots of kind of, you know, excitement about this meetup. And I drove an hour to attend this meetup. And it was quite extraordinary because on so many different levels, it was quite extraordinary. There were some people that clearly hadn't forgotten playground beefs from like 14 years earlier. And my overarching sense was, perhaps not at that moment, but perhaps in the days afterwards, oh, well, there's a reason why I didn't stay in touch with these people, because they're not my people, right? And so from that moment onwards, I've always thought it was really interesting. Obviously, I know Facebook isn't everybody's platform these days, but then along came Facebook. And at the end of the 2010s, I worked in a recruitment agency for a short period of time. And there were people who were sort of 7-10 years younger than me. And they'd have these Facebook accounts where they had like 700 friends, 800 friends, 1,000 friends. I'm thinking, that's exhausting. That's exhausting because A, they cannot possibly be your friends, because Dunbar's number defies that possibility. And secondly, you're putting yourself on show to people, like, what is your point? Do you want to be judged by all of these people? Because ostensibly that's what we're doing when we maintain a social media account. We are inviting others to judge us. And if we can't cope with how we judge ourselves, how the hell are we supposed to cope with the weight of the judgment of others?
And that validation seeking as well that I see so often of kind of like, you know, posting something and then seeking that external validation for yourself. It's such a dangerous, vicious cycle to kind of start getting into. And like you said, now the weird thing, I mean, like you said, Facebook is kind of, you know, had the weird thing where you could also, when people get recommended to you, you think, well, no, I actually don't want to befriend those people. There's a reason I don't want them recommended to me. But just because they're within my local area or something, all of a sudden you're kind of getting this very weird association with people.
I think you will never find inner peace as long as you are in any way dependent on the evaluation of others. And that kind of circles round to this state of becoming, doesn't it? Because the whole point, the whole brilliant, exciting, thrilling point about life and existence is that we are in perpetual motion and we are in a perpetual state of becoming. And maybe that is the dark underbelly of social media. It doesn't allow you to become another person because there's always a digital footprint of the person that you once were. And while on the one hand, I completely abhor any kind of discrimination, I sometimes also think it's very unfortunate that social media now allows people's profiles to be mined for contentious points that they may have made, you know, 10, 15 years ago. That's also not okay. Because the person that you may have been when you made a really stupid comment in your teens or in your 20s is not the person that you are today. I'm not saying, I mean, obviously there are some people who don't change and are indoctrinated to believe the things that they believe. But for the rest of us, there's no, you know, there's no right to be forgotten anymore. And I think that is debilitating, or can be debilitating.
I think something I suppose I'm curious about, Kat, is when we think about this becoming, I know we've kind of veered it quite heavily into social media because it is, I think it has such a phenomenal influence on us, more than we probably are sometimes aware of. Because I think the other thing that I was really conscious of with social media is that kind of collective belief that starts happening. So you know how you are in an echo chamber and you are in a void, and then all of a sudden everything starts getting reflected back at you. And I sometimes was questioning, okay, is what I'm thinking right now, is this a me thought, or have I been influenced, or consciously have I picked up something from somewhere that's making me think this way? And I was really starting to get maybe a little bit aware of how some of the things I was seeing was influencing my thoughts and my behaviors. So I suppose when it comes to this becoming, what would you kind of recommend for people to start thinking about or doing and kind of reconnecting with their authentic selves? Is there something that you've like practiced or seen that, you know, helps people to kind of start moving in this way?
So what I think you're talking about is thinking about thinking. It's kind of, it's critical thinking and self-inquiry and the convergence of the two. And I guess from my own point of view, I learned the value of both, perhaps rather by luck than judgment. I don't think I overthought them. A number of life experiences happened for me personally, and I realized at one point that I wasn't going to be able to make progress without help from a psychotherapist. And in and around that time, I developed an interest in coaching as well. And I think, you know, obviously the mainstream difference between coaching and psychotherapy is a good psychotherapist will help you unpick and make sense of the things that have happened to you in the past, whereas a great coach will help you build a picture of what you want your future life to be like. And I may be right or may be wrong, but I don't think there should be much overlap. I think they're quite distinct offerings, and I'm always slightly cautious when I come across people that say that they do both, because I think that one process, the rear view process, is quite emotionally loaded. And I suspect for most of us will contain an element of grief or loss that needs to be processed, whereas the coaching process, a forward reflecting process, ought to be more filled with potential and hopefulness and motivation for the future. But I think that both processes are as equally valid in helping you understand that thoughts are thoughts and feelings are feelings, and neither are static. And I think in this day and age, particularly where the media is so full of fake news or attention-seeking, fear-grabbing headlines, I think it's super helpful to question where we're getting our information from, to triangulate the authenticity of that information, and then to carve out the time so that we can actually feel how that information is landing with us, because that feeling, that gut hunch, that intuition will be our inner self, our value code, kind of making itself known to us. So I think thinking about thinking is a brilliant, brilliant thing. I think we're not taught by our cultures to think about it, because the way our education systems served up to us is know all of these things and you too can become great, which is total BS, by the way. That is not how life unfolds. But, you know, I think number one on the list of vital skills offered up by the World Economic Forum is critical thinking. And critical thinking for me contains in part the ability to think about the act of thinking. Metacognition. Is it not called metacognition?
Metacognition cat. Yeah.
There you go.
Ting.
Yeah.
If you're on a quiz show.
Pub quiz.
It's true though, isn't it? I think it's being that self-awareness of your own thoughts and being, yeah, critical of what they are, being an observer rather than being dragged along with it. And I think it's so fascinating to kind of watch it sometimes. Like, I'm really aware of sometimes how people react to certain things, and it really fascinates me because I can see how something's like they're kind of they're getting carried away with their own thought, and they haven't got that ability to kind of step back from what's happening and what they're thinking in order to kind of respond rather than react. And I think, like you say, maybe it's, you know, yeah, that those value codes as well, which I think so few people maybe really connected with their own values as well. You know, maybe they've connected with values on other levels. But until, I really like the quote, I don't know who it's by, it's it says your values aren't your values until they're tested. Until they're tested, they're just niceties that you think about yourself. I think that's so true. Until they, you know, become something that you would argue for or fight for, they are just nice things that we kind of go, yeah, I am kind of, you know, this orientated.
I think there's a maturity piece around this, and I don't wish to sound patronising to anybody that might feel that they're not mature, but I can only speak from my own experience. I was in my mid-late 20s and I was working internationally throughout the week and flying home every weekend to spend some time with my mother, who was in the process, a very long process of dying. And I would fly home on a Thursday night, spend a Friday in my UK office, go out on a Friday night with my mates, which involved basically some form of getting trashed, spend Saturday in some kind of recovery state, and then Sunday I'd go and see my parents, and Monday I'd fly back out again. And there was one weekend, and this was like, that was the de facto pattern. And it was, you know, it was kind of club scene, you know, big nights out, 20s, blah, blah. And there was one weekend, and I flew home, and the plans that had been loosely made disintegrated. And I was confronted with the reality that I was going to be on my own for the weekend. And I was absolutely, my initial response was absolute terror. I cannot be by myself. I don't know how to be by myself. I can't entertain myself. I can't keep myself busy. And I think when I look at that person through the lens of maturity that I have now, first and foremost, I will say being by yourself is a game changer. Learning to deal with and then enjoy your own company is the biggest game changer, the most transformational gift that you can ever give to yourself. So I'll say that one thing. But then I think, well, what was going on for me before that that led me to feel so terrorized by the idea of having to spend a weekend by myself? And I think for me, it would have been a combination of, well, the first thing, and I'm not sharing this with you because I want any kind of pity. I grew up in a household where my mother was very ill with cancer on successive occasions, and I realised a long time after the fact that mental illness was also kind of involved in that heady mix. So I spent a lot of my adolescence and young adulthood trying to escape the burden of something that I didn't understand. And I also spent that period trying to conform to norms that I didn't necessarily understand. And I think when you're a young adult, you spend so much of your time, like your areas of focus are not what they are when you hit your 30s or 40s. And granted, there are some people who can continue to go round that same old track, even into their 50s. But I would argue until you find yourself, your core, the essence of who you are, as I think I probably did that weekend, you're just going through motions. So I think the most valuable work that you can ever do is to do that work and find out who you are. And I'm not entirely sure, I suspect you might be able to do it, but I'm not entirely sure that you can do that fully without a thinking partner to help you work through the permutations of what that means. And that process then is so liberating and transformative, because it allows you to see that the whole of your existence is a process, a present tense process of becoming.
It's almost like there's a huge part of self-acceptance in this becoming. And, you know, it's not a destination. It is a journey and kind of an acceptance of who you are and an acceptance of the journey, would you say?
Yeah. And I think also, until you accept who you are, you will only ever, it's like trying to drive a car down the motorway in third gear. Until you can accept who you are. And into that, I would add, and all the things that have happened to you, because you spend the first decade or decade of your and a half of your life in environments that you've got very little control over, and you can't escape them because you're a minor. So great things may have happened to you, but for lots of people, bad things have happened. And I'm always drawn to the definition of trauma that is outlined by Dr. Gabor Mate. He says we tend to think that trauma is all the bad things that have happened to a person, but trauma can equally be the absence of good things that have happened to a person. And so I think having the willingness and the insight to arrive at a point of self-acceptance, that's kind of like day one. It's like a rebirth, isn't it? And in fact, I think, and I can't think who, is it Confucius? One of those wise Eastern prophets said,
Know thyself.
Or something like, there are 2 days that you're born. One is the day that you're born, and the other day is the day that, whatever it is. But the point at which you understand who you are is the point at which you can fully embrace becoming, because every single day thereafter is a refreshed opportunity to change your circumstance, change your environment, change yourself, you know, learn a new skill, show up differently. And that's not, I'm not saying any of those things because that's what society is telling you should be doing. For as long as you pursue what external forces tell you, or you think are telling you how to be and how to perform and behave, you'll always be disappointed and unfulfilled. But if you can find yourself and work on yourself, that's the game changer.
Yeah, and it has such a ripple effect as well when you do that. And I know it's, I think it was Brené Brown that said, you know, sometimes the reason people don't want to do the work is because it's going to be painful, but they don't realize they're already living with the pain.
Yeah.
And it's so true. It's kind of, you know, doing the deep personal work, you know, yeah, at times it is uncomfortable, but it provides so much opportunity for us to know ourselves and also understand more about where we see we fit into the world rather than from that external perspective. And I think one thing that sometimes doesn't help, I don't think, in this kind of becoming evolution is that idea of purpose as well, how you're meant to know your purpose, and it has to be such a defined thing. And it can feel, you know, quite panic inducing, like, oh my gosh, I need to know my purpose. What's my purpose? Like, you know, everyone, like, you get told at 16, you know, what do you want to do when you grow older? I don't know. Like, you know, there's always panic inducing kind of content about know your purpose, know your why. And it's kind of like, but I don't really know what that is yet. And if you feel like you don't know your purpose, it's almost like there's something wrong with you, that you're faulty, that, oh, everyone else knows their purpose and they're all being good little worker bees and working towards their purpose, but because you don't, you're faulty. So that kind of induces even more panic. Do you find that around purpose?
I'm so confused by the whole purpose agenda, because As far as I can see, and I may be wrong, there are two levels to purpose. One is an organizational purpose. Why are we here? What are we here to do? How are we going to achieve it? That, you know, that is organizational purpose. In terms of what's my purpose at an individual level, again, I come back to there is an element of maturity required around that. And actually, I'm not sure that any person under the age of 30 needs to understand what their purpose is, because surely, you know, there is an element of life before 30 where you should be going out and having all the experiences that life can afford you. And somehow I think personal and organizational purpose have become conflated, and in some regard almost give organizations permission not to address their purpose by deflecting it onto all the individuals that make up their workforce, and then counter that with, well, we can't talk about our purpose because everyone's struggling with, you know, to voice their own purpose. But I as a counter to that, I think the work that Ken Robinson did on identifying your gifts and your innate strengths is infinitely more useful. So he talked about finding your element, and really, you know, the role of the educational establishments was not to verbatim churn out cookie cutter replicas that could feed the university system and then, you know, the first tier employers. It was more to create an education system that cherished the unique strengths, gifts, and capabilities of each child as they uncovered them, and that the role of every educator ought to be to help each child find that one thing that they were uniquely equipped with as a talent. So, yeah, purpose I struggle with, because first and foremost, I mean, it's quite a nebulous thing, and I think we talk about it without defining it succinctly enough. And I think, you know, the purpose that I had when I was 25 was not the same as the one that I had when I was 35. So I think there's a lack of definition to purpose, and then I think there's a lack of permission for that purpose to evolve. And actually, as it stands right now, with all our societal systems collapsing, I think the most important purpose that needs to be clearly defined is organisational purpose. What does every institution stand for? What is its value to society? And what is it doing to transition towards more sustainable business practices that are far less extrapolative than they have been previously, both on Earth's natural resources and the people that work within those systems. That was my soapbox rant about purpose.
I love it, Kat. I love it. That's what we're here for. We're here for soapbox rants. So, kind of coming to, like, we've just shed the light on organisational purpose. And with the idea of this theme kind of for season 12 of being making the intangible more tangible, would you say that, you know, that becoming that sense of evolution can also be put towards how we look at kind of organisations that evolve, and actually, you know, rather than this kind of perfectionism that they seek out so often, is it's what's progress? What's that evolution? What are we kind of becoming? Would you say that that's something that can be reflected onto organisations when we think about it?
I think the work of every organisation right now is to identify how it creates value in the world that goes beyond bottom line outcomes. So, yes, an organisation needs to break even or turn a profit in order to continue to sustain itself over time. I am very anti the reality that is in exist, you know, that is today, that there are these ridiculous CEO pay gaps, and that inequality leads leaders to have very little awareness of what the lived experience is like for their internal stakeholders. I think every organisation is going to have to, whether it likes it or not, reckon with itself and identify how it delivers value within its ecosystem in a way, yeah, that goes beyond financial. And I think that process entails a really heartfelt exploration of who or what it wants to be 5 years from now. I have to say it's probably not much point in looking much further out than 5 years because of the level of global instability and uncertainty. But the ability to see itself objectively as it is today and then see a version of itself that it aspires to become, that's the work. And in addressing who or what an organisation aspires to become, that in and of itself requires far deeper introspection about what value it creates. You know, if you're in the business right now of creating goods that require raw materials that are finite, then your future sustainability is looking dubious because it's going to become harder and harder to access the raw materials that allow you to create whatever it is that you're creating. So on so many different levels, there is a requirement to introspect and really think about, like, the purpose of organizations historically and the purpose of successful organizations in the future. There will be some bridges that take you from the past to the future, but a lot of the past we can't take with us into the future because we're at this crisis inflection point in terms of the environment and the climate crisis. We cannot continue to consume at the level that we have been consuming. That's it. It's like there's no negotiation. That's it.
Oh my goodness, there's so much food for thought there, and I could literally carry on diving into this so much because it's so, yeah, infuriating that not more of us are waking up to this need for a deeper purpose beyond profit. You know, there's many great examples out there, like, you know, Patagonia, one of them, that, you know, do phenomenal work with putting purpose before profit. But are there any recommendations, Kat, as we begin to wrap up our conversation, of someone who's listening to this? Do you feel called to share a book or a podcast, anything that has helped your journey in this way?
Well, you've already referenced it earlier. You know, I think for me, when I first read Brené Brown's first book, I thought it was just me. That was a pretty phenomenal game changer. I think when we look, I'm not advocating for oversharing because I've got enough going on between my two ears. I don't need to hear about everyone else's psychodrama. But I think if we can normalize conversations about, and what I will really loosely call spiritual growth, I don't mean religious growth by any stretch of the imagination, but what I do mean is we all hold within ourselves the essence of who we are, and the sooner we can access the safe space with the thinking partner, whoever that may be, to figure out who we are, we will become way more equipped to live a more fulfilling life. if anybody is listening to this and they've managed to figure that all out by themselves without the need for a second person, then they totally need to come onto the podcast because I stand in awe of them. But I think there's no shame whatsoever in asking for help. In fact, I think the most courageous thing that anybody can do is to arrive at the point where their curiosity exceeds their inhibitions about themselves.
Thank you so much, Kat. Such wisdom in today's episodes. And I could really keep chatting about this topic. But thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast and for those recommendations as well. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Make It Thrive, the Company Culture Podcast, with me, your host, Lizzie Benton. If you've enjoyed listening and want to keep up with all things culture, don't forget to subscribe. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to welcoming you back next week.